Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trustmakers.
Hi, I'm Justin Blake, Executive Director of the Edelman Trust Institute, Edelman's think tank for advancing the study of trust in institutions. Welcome to a special three-part series of The Trustmakers, recording on the ground from the 2025 annual meeting of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland. Over the next few days, we'll be speaking with media, business, and government leaders about what they're seeing at this year's annual meeting in Davos. We'll also dive into the 2025 Edelman Trust Barometer, which we just launched this week. It also marks Edelman's 25th anniversary of studying trust. To kick off our Davos series, I'm pleased to be joined by Andrew Edgecliff Johnson, a reporter and editor who recently took on a new role as the CEO editor at Semaphore. Before that, Andrew spent 27 years at the Financial Times covering media, business, and U.S. news. And Andrew, you've been to Davos how many times?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me. Second, I'm slightly shocked to say that I've forgotten how many times I've been to Davos, but I do remember the first time I came was in 2007, when the great buzz around town was the excitement that the Google guys were here. They just bought YouTube. They had a very sexy Bond villain style lair set up where everybody was staying that we were paraded to meet Larry and Sergey for a very, very odd impromptu press conference where they didn't seem to know what they wanted to talk to us about. And what I remember principally about that was, first of all, falling over on a very icy driveway back from that press conference in front of Eric Schmidt and making a complete fool of myself. But secondly, this great hype at the time about how bloggers were the new Bono. They were the great celebrities of Davos, Arianna Huffington and others. And this was the year that the hottest accessory in Davos was to have an avatar in Second Life. If you remember that.
I do remember the whole Second Life moment. So with that story, you very much accredited yourself as a Davos expert. So before we dive any further in, let's actually zoom the camera out for a moment. Right now, we're recording this podcast in a fairly empty area where you have people scurrying around, setting up in something called the Congress Center in Davos. Can you just help ground people a little bit?
So we're about 3 hours train ride away from Zurich. We're up in the Swiss Alps in a pretty small and fairly humdrum Swiss ski village. This is not the fanciest ski resort you've ever stayed in, but for 1 week a year, for the past many, many years, it has transformed into this extraordinary hub for, frankly, the elites of politics, of finance, of technology and business. And everybody crowds into this slightly eccentric town with a lot of temporary structures. An awful lot of people who would normally be in five-star hotels are spending thousands of dollars to stay in glorified ski chalets if they're lucky. Some of them are in Airbnbs, like myself. Some are even in like camper vans. So everybody kind of huddles together. They make the most of it. There's usually a lot of packed snow on the ground. There's a little less snow on the sidewalks this time than we often see. The logistics of the event are completely bizarre. You're running from one plenary session to a one-to-one meeting with a contact, a client, or a CEO, and a huge cloud of FOMO hangs over the entire town. You can be talking to a Nobel laureate who's just found a cure for cancer and wondering if there's a more important conversation going on down the road that you should be part of.
And for those listening to this podcast who are perhaps here in Davos, do you have tips for being able to make the most of the experience and perhaps lessen that FOMO?
You've got a couple of options. A lot of people structure their week around the formal program of the World Economic Forum, where you may want to be in the big Congress Center, the big hall for the biggest speakers, the finance ministers, President Milei from Argentina, Donald Trump beaming in this week, fresh from his inauguration. A lot of people are here just to meet clients one-to-one. Most CEOs that I'm meeting this week say they're going to squeeze in 20, 30, maybe more client meetings, and they'll be doing that in the spaces that they've taken over. They've rented along the promenade, which is the main drag that runs through the town, where they've rebranded storefronts as under their own corporate brands. So you've got a couple of options. The most important thing is to make sure you've got a good dinner set up in the evening, preferably a good cocktail party to go to before or afterwards, because that's where the real business gets done.
You mentioned the storefronts on the promenade. How have those changed over time during the time you've been coming here?
Well, the branding of Davos just grows and grows every year. But I remember coming here just before the pandemic, where it was the peak of the ESG investing movement, the diversity, equity, and inclusion wave that had washed through the corporate world, the sustainability narrative that every brand wanted to be part of. And that was the messaging on every billboard, on every shop front in town. Walking down the promenade my first day here this week, I have to say there's a huge shift. Half the messages are about artificial intelligence. The other half are about productivity, growth, navigating the complexity of potential trade wars, and just finding a way for business to get done in this increasingly complicated world.
So it sounds a little bit, based on the branding on the main drag of the promenade, it's a little bit back to business. You said the first year you were here, one of the hot companies was Google. One of the hot emerging topics was Second Life. What do you see as either some of the hot companies or some of the big topics for this year's meeting?
I think the hottest companies are all those that are playing in the AI space. And that is not just the OpenAIs, the Microsofts, the Googles still, which are still throwing very big parties. Meta is here promoting their Meta glasses, which may be the next big thing or maybe the next Second Life. We'll find out in the next few years. But it's also the big consultancies. Every major mid-tier tech firm, every major management consulting firm is sending us a message about its ability to help clients navigate through this next great tech revolution.
And what are some of the big overall topics for this year? What are people really going to be talking about at those fancy dinners that you mentioned?
So I'm really looking for three themes. One is, what is the return that companies are getting on the AI investments they've made so far, and what kind of pace of future investment are we going to see in AI? Because there's definitely a mood here that this is the year where real money gets spent and real returns get seen. But I want to dig into that a lot. I am very interested in how the Davos crowd, which embraced sustainability, embraced corporate purpose, embraced a broader mission to business life, finesses that now. We've lived through this backlash for a couple of years now against the whole environmental and social missions of companies. But mostly, the biggest theme that I am pursuing this week, that all of us are trying to understand, is what does the second presidency of Donald J. Trump mean for business and the wider world?
Andrew, what are you hearing from business leaders in terms of now, again, President Trump?
Well, this is the split-screen Davos. The people here have one eye on the stage and the other eye on Washington. Everybody watched the inauguration. A lot of CEOs who were meant to be here at the very start of the week delayed their trips so they could be at the inauguration, or at the very least be at their desks when President Trump started signing executive orders that could affect their businesses. And a few people stayed home who might otherwise have been in Davos this week. The big picture is that what Donald Trump decides in the first weeks and months of his presidency will affect almost everybody represented in Davos, whether they are a world leader or a business leader. Right now, the business community, where I'm spending most of my time pursuing the world's CEOs, is giving him the benefit of the doubt. There is a level of optimism and even excitement that he will unleash American dynamism, that animal spirits will be allowed to rip, that we'll see a lot of mergers and acquisitions, that they'll get an easier ride than they were getting under the Biden administration, and that a lot of the campaign rhetoric on immigration and even tariffs won't turn out to be quite so harsh in reality.
Great. Going backwards from the kind of three themes that you mentioned, we touched on Trump. Let's touch on DEI for a moment. What sorts of answers are you going to be listening for in order to figure out how much of this is a retracting of how you talk about these efforts versus a true retracting of the efforts themselves?
I'm looking for precisely that question of what have you changed in practice since you were messaging this, since you're putting your DEI efforts up on billboards and banners along the promenade in Davos just a few years ago, because the internal pressures in organizations have not changed. People do want a diverse workforce in most businesses, and most CEOs I speak to have convinced themselves of the business case for that. There is, though, particularly in the United States, a much greater awareness of the potential for reputational or particularly legal risks and challenges to DEI programs, to any program that is seen to be potentially discriminatory against one group of individuals or another.
Looking at AI, what sorts of companies are you seeing beginning to get a return on their AI investments?
I think what's interesting this year is after all the excitement and the hype around the big AI platforms, whether it's OpenAI or the likes of Meta and Google, which have built enormous in-house AI capabilities, this is moving more into the enterprise. Now, that is not the sexiest part of the AI story. Obviously, we all get very excited when we're all let loose on ChatGPT for the first time, or Perplexity or Claude or whatever it might be. But this is the year that businesses with real operations, with enormous data sets, are starting to understand quite what they can do with those data sets and are really starting this year looking for the promised productivity enhancements that we've been hearing about for a couple of years now, but not quite seeing the fruits of.
Well, I like the idea of focusing on the unsexy AI for a moment. As you know, we just published our 2025 Edelman Trust Barometer, Trust in the Crisis of Grievance. It finds that 40% of respondents approve of hostile activism to drive change. This was particularly true among young people. It feels like people's frustrations have now reached a breaking point. You're a journalist, you've covered business, you look at society more broadly. How does this sense of grievance track with what you're seeing?
I think it very much builds on something we've seen over many years, which I know the Edelman Trust Barometer and others have tracked, which is a sense of declining trust in every major institution, including, I should say, media, my own industry. I think we are living through the consequences of everything from the financial crisis to the pandemic. I think 2020 was an extraordinary year when we were all locked inside for weeks or months and went slightly stir crazy. We had the awful murder of George Floyd, the subsequent protests, and we had the backdrop in the United States of extremely polarized politics. We'd had, by that point, 3-4 years of Donald Trump's presidency. We were gearing up for an election year. And I think a lot of these issues crested then, and we've been living with the backlash to them. And so a lot of the institutions here are feeling that backlash now, but this has an edge to it, which is different.
Talk about that edge, and is that edge new in terms of what you're observing?
I do think there's been an unleashing of behavior that was not seen as acceptable before. And a lot of that is social media behavior. I think the public discourse has become a lot harsher over the last several years as people have got used to insulting each other, and much worse, online. It has become much more acceptable than it would have been maybe 10 years ago in those exciting days when we were all thrilled that the Google guys were coming to town and that the bloggers were here. We are seeing a darker side to that. Obviously, I sit in New York. The U.S. business community has been utterly shaken by the murder of Brian Thompson, a healthcare executive, in recent weeks. And that has added a new level of concern in the corporate echelons about where this might be going.
Regarding the aftermath of the murder of Brian Thompson, have you spoken to many CEOs or those around them about their reaction to the online almost martification of the person who murdered him?
Yes, and those I've spoken to were very shocked by that. There are certainly a few executives who I notice have a more visible security detail around them in Davos this week, and in the weeks I've been meeting CEOs leading up to Davos. I'd say the vast majority of them do still see this as a pretty unusual one-off. I don't think, you know, touching wood here, that there is a widespread expectation that violence against CEOs is going to become routine, but there is a more watchful mood. And I think what's interesting is it is making companies start to think maybe we can't tune out all of our critics. We need to take a little bit of a closer look at are there areas where we can diffuse some of this anger.
Let's focus there for a moment, because it's our belief that many of these grievances exist because there's a fundamental lack of fairness in the system. When you speak to executives, when you speak to CEOs, are they sounding a little bit more sensitive to ensuring a more fair and just system?
I would say they were sounding more sensitive to that 4 or 5 years ago, to be honest, when, as I say, I think a lot of the social missions of companies came to the fore between about 2018, 2021. That really felt like the peak years for this discussion about how do companies serve a wider swath of society than just their shareholders. And if anything, I think we've retreated a little bit from that. But I think now we need a reframing of that discussion to try and understand how business can take the temperature down, because this is becoming quite critical. Not, I think, for just for the personal security of individuals running these companies, but really for their broader license to operate, which has been, frankly, under debate now for several years.
Yeah, I think that's good advice for business. You mentioned trust in media a few minutes ago. 70% of our Trust Barometer respondents worry that journalists and reporters are purposely trying to mislead people. Trust in media is not doing well right now. What are some of the things that media can do to help gain back more trust?
Well, if you look at the charts, trust in media has been declining in the United States since the mid-1970s, when All the President's Men came out fictionalizing the Washington Post's wonderful reporting on Watergate. So this is not a new phenomenon, but clearly it has been accelerating. I remember about 8 years ago now, driving down to Kentucky to do a long reporting trip, asking ordinary Americans why they don't trust journalists like me, because I have been lucky to work in a newsroom all my life, in different newsrooms all my life, where if I made a single mistake, if I got somebody's name incorrectly spelled, we would publish a correction, and that would be a bad day in the office for me, and I would feel it. And so to go from that context where I know that I'm working with people who try every day to get the facts right, to seeing this distrust rise to a majority of our audiences was very, very jarring for me. And I think you have two responses as a journalist. You can either hide and say, well, people are idiots, or they've been misled by foolish and wily politicians who want to distance themselves from fact-based media by saying that all media cannot be trusted. Or you can look in the mirror a little bit, look at what it is that we're doing that may have contributed to the doubts in people's mind at the very least. And one of the reasons that I loved working for the Financial Times for so long, and that I am now delighted to be a Semaphore, is that both of these businesses think very hard about trust. And Semaphore was built from the ground up to be a more transparent model, which helps explain to its audience how the sausage is made.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about the Semaphore model, why you made the jump, and the very interesting role you'll be playing there.
Well, as I said, I have a wonderful career at the Financial Times, which I think is one of the great, great news organizations on the planet. But when Semaphore came along, I admired them from the start for the way that, as a new digital media brand, they understood that distrust was a problem for all of us as journalists and set out to try to remedy it. And one of the ways they do that is the simple formatting of stories, where they will put, first and foremost, the news, what happened, and then the analysis of that news, then the journalist's viewpoint, and then some rival viewpoints, some counterweights of, you know, there are people out there who disagree with this viewpoint, and I will present that disagreement to you, and you, dear reader, can make your own mind up. So I think that is a pretty interesting and intelligent way to acknowledge the trust problem that journalism has and to start trying to remedy it.
And your role there is very focused on CEOs?
Yes. This week, launching a product we call the CEO Signal, which is a newsletter for and about CEOs. Now, there are many CEO-branded media outlets out there already, but in practice, very, very few of them go to a specific CEO audience. We are only making this available to CEOs running businesses of $500 million revenue or higher. So you know, if you're receiving this, that this has been written for you, designed for you, specifically in your role as CEO. There is wonderful broader business coverage out there that's very widely available, but it's mostly being written for people who are slightly more junior levels of your organization. If you are running a very large, complicated company in a very complicated time, you've got some very specific insights you need to see, and you want to soak up the intelligence from your peer group on how you meet this challenge of leadership.
So my guess is, knowing you pretty well, you interview probably at least 100 CEOs a year, probably every Davos, maybe 20 or so.
It will be about 20 this week, yeah.
I wonder, over the time that you've been a journalist, how has the kind of dynamics of CEO interviews changed? Like, are CEOs getting more interesting, less interesting? Is there a different dance that you do with them? How has that evolved?
The barriers between journalists and CEOs have gone up. And one of the reasons for that is a more cautious sense among CEOs that if they say a word wrong, they're going to be punished for it, either by their investors or by those other stakeholders, their employees from different political viewpoints, different social backgrounds, or by activists out there, and who might be the hostile activists you mentioned. But I think it's also about the changes in the media landscape we've seen. You know, over the last decade, the rise of social media like LinkedIn, which has allowed CEOs to become thought leaders in their own lunch breaks, has given them an unfiltered, unmediated outlet to audiences they want to reach. We see a lot more, if you like, corporate media, where companies will put out very polished videos of their CEOs, very polished blog posts. They may have their own channels and their own, obviously, internal communications. And so I think they see the average journalist as a slightly trickier interlocutor than that. At the same time, I think they've also discovered that a lot of those safer, more packaged outlets that they have don't really break through with all of the audiences that they need to reach.
Yeah, that may be true about the audiences, but one of the interesting trust findings I know you've seen before is that corporate media is actually more trusted by more respondents than traditional media, which is certainly one that surprises us, but is a finding. Let me close with the concept of building almost individual trust between people like you and people like me who work for an agency or around an executive. Like, what could we be doing to work together more effectively and get to a place where the interactions you're having with executives and CEOs is really effective for both institutions?
I think Davos is all about relationships, and everybody here is here to exchange ideas and to build those relationships with the people who are going to be relevant to them. And that's true in the media world as well. We'll all spend a lot of time with each other, you know, the communications functions or journalism functions over the course of the week. having done this now for 30 years, to my shock, I have learned that I value the communications professionals who understand their companies or their clients or whatever institution they work for, who can help explain those to me in good times and in bad times, who don't just hide when the headlines are negative, but who are willing to pick up the phone and who are willing to add some context. I know that they have a very different point of view and a very different job from the job that I have. But I think their understanding of my job and the audience I have to reach is a critical part of that relationship. And the professionals in communications who do understand, stop and think for a moment about what it is that I'm after and that my audience wants to know, and are not deluding themselves that they can just stick to safe spaces for their CEO, are the ones who tend to get the most credibility.
That's a great tip. And I really have always appreciated in our work together how you're always really straightforward and candid with me. It just makes everything so much easier and cleaner that way, which I appreciate. I also appreciate you being here today to kick off our Davos series. And I hope you have an incredible week. To our listeners, I hope you tune in to the rest of our Davos series as well. And thank you for listening to The Trustmakers.
Thank you for tuning into The Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.